So it is 5 o'clock and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And as always happens on Tuesdays at 5 o'clock, and yes, it is 5 o'clock, daylight savings has taken effect, and it is 5 o'clock here and it is time for office hour. So before we begin, we remind our listeners, as always, that the views that are presented on the show, they may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So here we are. This is Professor Jay speaking, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, ready to take another adventure here on our public affairs show to go off and knock on a door around campus and find something interesting that's happening, somebody who's studying and thinking about fascinating worlds that we may not have explored before. It's a big campus. There's lots of doors in here. Can you hear me knocking? I'm knocking as I always do. And I'm really pleased today because I'm knocking on not only a really interesting door, but also someone who I've considered a friend for a long time. And I'm happy to welcome to Office Hour John Bowe, who is a professor emeritus from the writing program. So welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Naomi. It's nice to be here.
Yes. And John has many talents. He's a man of many talents. So we're going to be talking about several different things. He has a new book out about Shakespeare, and we'll definitely be talking about that. But the way that I first encountered John was as a storyteller, and I think he's quite famous as a storyteller. And I one night went, that's the first time I had met you, John, is I happened to show up at Berkeley when you were telling stories. And it was totally thrilling. My husband and I went, and we were telling Cocopelli stories.
Oh, great. I remember that.
Yeah, and that was a great deal of fun. And then it turned out that you were a faculty member, and you taught, you did a variety of different types of things in the writing program, but you also taught storytelling, and the students loved to take your courses, and I often talked with them about that, and the honor students who did storytelling courses with you. So there's just so many things, but we're going to start off, as we always do, to kind of follow our usual pattern, which is we want to find out how you became interested. And I think being a storyteller is not an obvious career choice. No. So how does somebody, do you wake up one day, were you intrigued by stories when you were young? Or how does someone grow up to be a storyteller?
Well, I liked performing. I did stand-up comedy in high school and liked getting up in front of people and making them laugh. Then in graduate school, I became interested in Carl Jung, and realized that a big part of education in Jungian psychology was studying fairy tales, that fairy tales were supposed to sort of represent the collective unconscious of the whole culture. They're like the equivalent of dreams. So I started teaching at UC Extension. I all taught during graduate school because I needed the money, a course in fairy tales. Since the students were mostly all adults, many of them worked and hadn't read the fairy tales I assigned, so I had to tell them Briar Rose or Frog Prince or whatever I was going to talk about. One early year, a woman, well-known storyteller, Ruth Stotter, who I work with now, I just taught a course with her last weekend, took my class and told me, hey, you know, you can make a living telling stories. You don't have to interpret them. And I realized that often the students preferred my telling to my interpretation. So I started performing at, and there's a whole world of storytelling, of festivals and performance at conventions and corporate such things. One can get a lot of work as a storyteller, and it satisfied my performance, Jones. I still like thinking about what stories mean. Mm-hmm. It's important to me in telling them that I, even if I don't talk to the audience about what I think the Frog Prince means or Briar Rose, it's important to me that I have some sense that I think they have a deeper meaning. But I just started doing the performances.
Telling stories.
You're just telling the stories, and people would like them.
What were you in graduate school supposed to be doing? I'm just curious to go back there. Were you in getting an English?
Getting a PhD in English from UC Berkeley, yeah.
This is the sort of more standard route to doing literary studies.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And I needed money because
What graduate student does not need money.
And so I could teach these courses. I teach any course at all at UC Extension, fantasy, fairy tales. I got to interview Ursula Le Guin and Maurice Sendak and people like that because I put on weekend spectaculars because I was a good performer.
Uh-huh.
So I'd, and I ended up finding out I could make a little money telling stories, too.
Well, presumably you also found you had a talent and an enjoyment?
Yes, a talent and an enjoyment. I'm actually a very introverted person, but I like being in front of an audience. I quite respond. If I see a microphone, I often want to get up and say a few words. I can't help myself. I feel it's rather childish of me, but I really like to perform and have a chance to tell. Let me tell you a story.
Uh-huh.
And I've always been a person who gathered jokes and told jokes.
Mm-hmm. As you said, you're doing stand-up comedy, but that kind of what you, was kind of replaced ultimately in your as a storyteller. I mean, do you still do sort of more standard comedy?
No, but my storytelling, if I tell Briar Rose, I get laughs.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to, there are two kinds, my dear friend Deanna Wolkstein was a storyteller who liked to make people cry.
Ah.
And I've never, and that's a perfect legitimate route. It's like liking King Lear.
Mm-hmm.
There's something purgative about tears and seeing the sadness of life. I've always gone for the laughs.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, are you saying then that storytellers do tend to go have a certain path and they're not likely to be eclectic?
Yeah, most of them have a certain style of what they like to do. Some people, you know, I mean, everyone's eclectic, does a lot of things, but I know one storyteller who tells a whole lot of Jewish stories,
mm-hmm.
Joel Ben-Ezi. He's great. He's
yes,
a great
he is.
Storyteller.
I've heard his stories.
But he has a certain kind of story
schtick,
you think of
you
his
say.
Schtick, his
yes.
schtick that he does.
Uh-huh.
And some storytellers, like English storytellers from England, don't tell any true life stories. They believe in just traditional folk tales, fairy tales. American storytellers often mix up a true life story with a fairy tale. I like doing that, telling a fairy tale and then telling a true life story that amplifies the theme of the fairy tale.
I do remember hearing you tell stories, and they were often actual life stories.
Yeah.
So is that sort of you? Is sort of your characterization of yourself as a storyteller? You do fairy tales or things that are sort of like mm-hmm. that, but you also tell stories from your own life.
From my own life, and I learned that from my mother, who would have never stood up and talked to people in public, but at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee, she was the world's best storyteller, telling about her youth and what she did and how she used to. Oh, as a teenager, she and her friend would look in the newspaper to see where there was a wake. They were Catholics, and they'd crash the wake and go into with the kitchen where the men were drinking and telling stories, and they'd get free food and alcohol. And this is how on Friday nights, because that was wake night in Catholic St. Louis. And she tells stories like that that stayed with me. I tell a lot of her stories.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone tells stories. When I taught integrated studies, the honors program of storytelling, it's very easy to learn to do well.
Hmm.
Because everyone naturally tells stories. When you're home, what did I do today? You tell a story, and you can perfect the art if you start being conscious that you're telling stories. Hmm. Ah, what can I do to bring some more dynamics in my voice, to go up and down, to bring emotion, to not talk too fast? How do I stand? You sort of have certain techniques you can, but the natural storytelling is sort of built right in us. Unlike, you know, not everybody can sing. But almost everybody can tell a story.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. Some people say that everybody was naturally a poet, you know, and that it just gets people lose their attachment or their connection to poetry. That children can draw, and then around third and fourth grade, they suddenly start to feel that their drawings don't look realistic. So you're making the argument today that human beings are naturally storytellers. But that somehow what happens then?
Well, people still tell stories. They just don't try to do better at it. They take it for granted. They tell, let me tell you what happened today, honey. I
mm-hmm.
say coming home from work, or what did you do in school today?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a child, you coax the child, they might tell a story of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike people stop drawing, which I knew an artist who told her 5-year-old she was giving drawing lessons to adults. And the 5-year-old said, what, did they forget how to draw? Which I always thought was wonderful. But most people don't forget how to tell stories. My wife would never perform, but she tells stories.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you what happened today. Or if she's out with her friends, I always ask her, did anybody say anything interesting? And I'll get a story about what somebody told about.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So let's think about the difference between telling a story and writing a story.
Yes.
Because I'm in the process of trying to get my students to write short stories by taking their dreams, just because it's easier to get people to get a narrative with lots of action by taking something from their dream. But it seems like maybe what you're saying is that the technique for translating and becoming a storyteller is easier than the techniques we have to go struggle through if we want to be write written stories.
Yes. When I published a bunch of essays, some humorous, and I worked on back and forth between, I'd do a rough draft by telling the story out loud. Then I'd write it down and shape it, and then I'd tell it out loud again to an audience. So I go back and forth between orality and written. Hans Christian Andersen did a similar thing. He always read aloud to hear the voice of it.
He read aloud to an audience?
To an audience. He was a famous performer. Lewis Carroll first told Alice as an actual story to Alice Little and her two sisters.
Hmm.
There's a great benefit, I think. I used to have in advanced composition make my students, for at least one paper, stand up and tell the story of the paper to the class and then write it. And that was the rough draft. Then you get a voice in your writing because you've heard what it sounds like out loud. And when you're telling something out loud, you can tell when you're boring your audience. They yawn,
true.
They're not looking at you. Then you think, well, maybe I should cut that out or do that differently. Mm-hmm. When you write, you can't tell that the audience is bored because you haven't tried it out on them.
Well, and as a result, there's a lot of really boring papers out there. Having grown up and now as an academic, grew up on boring papers and I've spent much of my life reading boring papers.
The challenge for me as a teacher was to get them not to write boring papers.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt it's partly the assignment, whatever I can do to get them write something I want to read. Mm-hmm. And none of my colleagues in the writing program are like that. But the one thing I miss of teaching is the papers.
Mm-hmm.
I liked reading papers. I get to do it all alone and respond to the student. I felt it was a creative act. What am I going to write back? And usually I try to generate a paper that would have something like one assignment I used a lot would be to write a story of the natural history of the lies they people tell. Categorize all the kinds of lies you tell and you tell yourself and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That was always fun to read people's stories of what they lied about. And you can get people to say something interesting because if I was sat down next to some student on a car ride, we'd have an interesting conversation.
That is true.
Why do they write boring papers? Because they think that's what they're supposed to do.
Yep. Well, often they're given topics that can be a little bit boring.
Often they're
given
topics that can be a little boring and nothing that leads them to find something interesting to say.
So I want to go back to one of the points you made, which is I think it'd be great. We're going to encourage all our listeners to get your central techniques then.
Mm-hmm.
We heard about how you do a written paper by making it more oral.
Yeah.
So what would you tell somebody are the basic techniques of being a storyteller?
Oh, well, first have a good story.
Okay.
Select your find a material that you're confident that's a good story.
How do they know that by testing and
what you think what you know? I'm sure you as a teacher have certain stories you've told several times to students because they're good stories.
Yes,
you start with your A material that you've told before. You've told your friend before. You've told what happened to you when you were seven. You think of your childhood. It's amazing. I was unemployed once years ago, so I wrote everything I knew about my childhood. I got to 100 pages and was done. That's all I remembered.
Hmm.
But you start out, what do you actually remember? What you remember in your life are your stories. It's so much of it we forget.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding to me. And so you find what you remember and then try to tell it. If you're doing it publicly, not say and a lot.
Not say and Okay.
And
so
how
the
you
first
do that,
story, the first rule is start with a good story. And I must say I've taught for a number of years. I do have stories that I treasure because I just know many times students have gotten something out of it. So you start with a good story and then you say not a lot.
That's one of the things you do. And you do that by using silence, like Miles Davis doesn't fill all the space up. He doesn't go, he goes, ba-do-ba-dee-ba-do. You pause.
Uh-huh.
People don't pause because they're afraid of silence.
Hmm.
And so they go, so you fill every blank. You use the silence like a musician does to make the drama.
Hmm.
I always, in telling a story, think ahead of time what my first line is.
Mm-hmm.
If I can get the first line, then the whole story tends to flow from there. It's like the beginning of the tune.
Hmm.
So I'll try to think, how am I going to begin this story?
Mm-hmm.
And you have some shape to, from the beginning to get to the ending.
You have some idea of where you're headed.
You know the story already. You're not improvising.
Mm-hmm.
I would hate to have to get up and tell a story I'd never told before or never thought of before. Just be handed a prompt, tell this story. That would be really hard.
Well, people do that. I mean, there are improv places.
Yeah.
which is, I guess it's worth a little bit of a thought that somehow that is a different technique.
It's a different technique, and improv tends to be a group thing.
Yes, that is true.
That you're playing off improvising somebody else. I co-told a story at the Jung Institute once. I told Eros and Psyche, the story from Apuleius is the Golden Ass. It's a 50-minute story.
Wow.
And I told it with a woman who was much, I mentioned her a second time, she's dead now, Deanna Wolkstein, a very famous storyteller in the storytelling world. And we rehearsed, our rehearsal was we met at Green's and talked about love. When have you been in love? What do you think about love? And that's all she wanted to do, and she was more famous than I, so she got to choose what we did. All we started with was she would go first. So we got on stage. There must have been 300 people there. It was a big, big Jungian weekend. They used to have those. And I was all nervous till I was sort of being Eros, the male, and she was being Psyche, the female in the telling, till at one point she leaned against me and put her head on my shoulder. And I just relaxed. A woman's laying up against me. It seems to like me. Ah, life is good. And I was able to carry on telling the story and get in the flow and improvising with her. That was all improvised. You know, we knew what the story was, but we had to say this or that. We didn't change. We had to follow the plot. Mm-hmm. We didn't change anything. Improv, you actually make up new things. Mm-hmm. That's a different game. I've never really done that.
You know, I'm quite struck because sometimes my students, one of the things they do is they do get up and speak extemporaneously about something. We sort of set that up as something to just try. And it's quite difficult. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether students, over your time of teaching, did you see trends in terms of capacities of students to just get up and talk about topics? Or do you think it's that we always feel that people are more inhibited about that and there isn't really any trend and that all that students need is always the same thing, which is just, you know, a little bit of confidence and a little bit of direction.
Yeah, and practice. I'm so glad to hear you get up and make your students tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't often enough, I realize this not right away teaching at college, but I realize soon enough that many of these students have never in a class had to get up and make a presentation.
That is true.
It's great. They get better at it.
Yes.
You can get better. And you give them, when I taught the storytelling class, every class, I and all the students would write an evaluation, what you did well and badly. One of the classic things to do badly is run away from applause at the end of the story. You got to stand up there and take
it. Okay, your listeners, that's the next thing. So
yeah.
Not too many ums, use the silence. I think that's really a brilliant point, actually, and I'm going to remember that. Yeah. And then not to run away when you get applause. Yes. What are you supposed to do when you get applause?
Stand up there and accept it. People are going to like you. If somebody's not seems to not like what you're saying, don't look at them.
Uh-huh.
Look at the people who are nodding and smiling because you feel much more confidence.
Uh-huh.
Make sure you don't just hit one note when you talk. That's the most boring way to talk. It's like music. You go up and down.
Mm-hmm.
If you're nervous, take a deep breath before you start. That's a classic performance thing. It slows your heart rate and everything down to breathe slowly. So you stand up there.
Did you ever have any storytelling disasters?
Oh, once I told a story for Carl Jung's 100th anniversary, and it was a giant, almost 1,000 people there, oddly.
That's a large audience.
It was the largest audience I ever had at the Palace of Legion of Honor. And I used a bad word in the story, in the Shakespeare word, the C word in my story that was part of Shakespeare's allusion. And the whole audience gasped and didn't like me for saying this word in public.
For bad use of language.
For bad use of language. I just went on. I figured my dog still likes me. My wife likes me. What does it matter? There's the great scene in Bill Murray's Meatballs, one of my favorite movies, where he leads all the kids chanting, "It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter."
Yeah.
If everybody thinks you're stupid, so what?
Yeah, well, I don't think most of my students feel that way. I think they're quite self-conscious.
Well, I would, in the storytelling class, play the scene from Bill Murray's to chanting, "It just doesn't matter." Don't feel self-conscious. We're all idiots. Everybody's a fool and messes up sometimes. Great thing about storytelling is you can mess up and go back and say, "I forgot to tell you." Music, I play music a lot. You can't do that with music.
That
you
is
say,
true.
You say, "I left out the four chord."
The rondo.
You can't tell. You can't say there's no excuse. You have to go on and press on somehow. Storytelling is great because you can just in the middle, "Oh, I forgot to tell you the important thing."
Uh-huh. Nobody cares. Everybody's happy with that.
That's the fluidity of storytelling as opposed to the rigidity of music.
Yes. Even jazz is rigid. You have to hit the chord lines. You can be fluid and improvise on it, but you have to go from C to F to G minor or whatever the chord progression is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's another really brilliant point, because it's pointing out that the storyteller is the god of this world. Mm-hmm. And whatever you're going to tell, you're the only one that knows where this world is really going and what order you have to put it in, and you can adjust and take, and nobody, it's not like listening to Beethoven's Fifth everybody knows exactly what's going to come next. The storyteller is the person who shapes everything.
Yeah, and you make the story your own. That's a classic thing storytellers talk about. Mm-hmm. If I'm telling Briar Rose, it's going to be different than if you're telling Briar Rose.
Okay, so what are you, are you saying that your personality, there's a little bit of John Bow in every story?
Oh, for sure. For mm-hmm. sure. You what can you do except use your personality?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more you perform, the more you get used to how you use your personality, how you bring it out.
So give us an example of that so that the listeners can understand how something personal your version of the story is.
Oh, The Frog Prince, the first story in the Grimm's collection. Anyone you put first is always one you think is really good. So they obviously thought it was a good story.
Uh-huh.
There was a girl whose favorite toy was a golden ball, and she'd go every day and throw the ball up in the air and catch it, throw the ball up in the air and catch it. She threw the ball way up in the high in the air and dropped it, and it fell into a well. She was crying. She wanted her ball. A frog heard the little girl crying and said, "What's the matter, girlie?" "I forgot my ball. I lost it." "I'll get it for you." "Oh, thank you, please." "Well, I'll get it for you if you promise to take me home and let me eat off your plate and sleep with you in your bed." "All right, I promise." The frog goes down, gets the ball, gives it to the girl. The girl runs away immediately. Doesn't give it to the frog. I'll do the rest of the story quickly. Girl goes home eating dinner with her father. There's a little knock on the door, like your knock. The king says, "Daughter, get..." I don't know why the king doesn't have servants, but the king says, "Daughter, get the door." She opens the door. It's the frog. "Girlie, you said you were..." She slams the door. She says, "Father, it's nobody. It's somebody, daughter." The daughter tells the story. The father says, "Daughter, you have to keep your word. A princess always keeps her word. Let the frog in. Now let it eat off your plate." And she says, "That's disgusting. I'm not going to eat anymore. I'm going to bed." "Oh, take me, girlie." "I'm not going to..." "Yes, you are going to take..." That king says, "You are going to take the frog to bed. You pray your words." And she takes the frog to bed. She gets in her night clothes, climbs in bed. The frog's on the bureau. The frog says, "I get to sleep in your bed. Remember, that's the deal." She says, "No, you don't." The frog says, "Yes, I do. I do. I do." And the girl takes the frog, picks it up, and says, "No, you aren't, you nasty frog," and throws him against the wall in anger. And it turns into a handsome prince, who she sleeps with and in the morning tells the king she's engaged with. I like in that story, first the ball. I played basketball all my life. I still play full court basketball. I evoke in the feeling of throwing the ball and catching it what I've done my whole life, playing ball games. The only thing that kept me sane as a young man was playing ball games. The countless hours I've thrown a ball against the wall or a ball in a hoop have been nothing wasted in that for me. So that story, that moment evoked to me, and the positive power of anger in the story. Unlike the French version where she kisses the frog to redeem him.
Yes.
In the Grimm, she gets angry. Often a thing girls aren't supposed to do, especially. But I've often believed my mother was really good at getting angry. The best person I've ever known, my mother. But I always believe there's a reason to let anger come out and have your feelings. And I love that part of the story.
So the part where she loses the ball must have had a lot of meaning for you as well. Because what you're saying is balls were very important. And so therefore you have a lot of empathy for her.
I have an empathy. And I also have association. Black Elk, whose book I used to love, he talks about the Wakantanka, the great spirit, is the ball that we're all supposed to be holding. And if you lose the ball, it's like losing Tao. It's mm-hmm. like the Tao is sort of a circle. You're losing touch with what you need if you lose the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling of losing the ball and having the ball gone, I can relate personally to that idea.
Right. And
dropping a ball. I still remember dropping a line drive. I was playing shortstop when I was in seventh grade in a whatever league game. And the line drive comes to me and I drop it. I still think about it. Is that ridiculous?
Yes.
But losing the ball has such a such a powerful, powerful thing. I remember many errors I've made in my life.
It's true. Yeah. It's really true. I have a few. I think you ask almost anybody, they have a few terrifying gym stories.
Yes, terrifying gym stories. Yes.
From some experience with, and team experiences and all of that. So, also in the relationship to the woman, the relationship to your mother. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you see that the female figure in the story reminds you of her mother, and that also makes it a special value for the story.
Yes, I think that's why I learned all early on to value and respect women's anger. Mm. I had sisters and a mother who would get angry at me sometimes, and it was often well deserved, the anger. Mm-hmm. And so I love the moment in the story. Usually when I tell it, if it's not on the radio, I use an expletive that she says to the frog.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you for not getting us in trouble on the radio.
Yeah, bull blank frog and throws the frog against the wall, because I love that girls get to get angry too. Mm-hmm. That they can be mad too, that they don't have to be well behaved. That's like Alice in Wonderland. At the end of each of those books, she gets angry finally. She's so polite and she's a model of great behavior, trying to find humor and manners and everything. Then she loses her temper. You're all a pack of cards and turns them all over. You know, and finally she's had enough and gets angry. And I think that's just a great ending, that the Frog Prince girl has the same attitude, that she's willing to get angry.
Okay, so that is a story which I very much can see that you have made your own.
Yeah,
That's very much your own. So we have actually reached the end of the first segment of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and I'm talking with John Bowe, the storyteller and Shakespearean scholar, emeritus from the University Writing Program. And we will take a short break for some public service announcements. And then when we come back, we'll talk about one of your other many hats. We'll talk a little bit more about Shakespeare when we come back. So stay with us. We will be back in just a minute. So we are back now, Professor Jay and Office Hour. And we're talking with John Bowe today, Professor Emeritus from the University Writing Program. In the first part of the show, we talked about his career as a storyteller. And now we're going to switch to one of his other areas of interest. You did say you were in graduate school to get a PhD in English, and you've been interested in Shakespeare. I'm curious, were you studying Shakespeare in your PhD program? Was that in particular what you were working on?
Yes.
So already by the time you were in graduate school, you had a big commitment to Shakespeare.
Yeah, that was the main part of my dissertation. I also did Virgil's eclogues for a crazy 100 pages.
So how did you become interested in Shakespeare?
Oh, it's funny, my parents, neither of whom graduated college, my father was an ex-convict who didn't graduate high school, so they'd have never seen a Shakespeare play, although my father did read. In high school, I took an advanced English class where we read one Shakespeare play, King Lear, and I remember telling my girlfriend, now my wife, that if I had time, I could write the best paper ever. And then the top floor of the school was set on fire. I didn't do it. So school was closed for a week. And I went to the library and did this research and wrote, I thought, a great paper on astrological symbolism in King Lear, Draco, and Ursa Major, and what the myths of those stars which are in the play have to do with the play. And in response, the teacher gave me the lowest grade I'd gotten all year because he thought I'd plagiarized it, I realized.
Oh.
But I actually did research. But that still set me off on loving Shakespeare, even though I hated that teacher. Then in college, I took a year-long course from Theodore Baird at Amherst, and I got the highest grade I ever got at the college.
And this time you weren't accused of plagiarism.
This time I wasn't accused. I was not accused of plagiarism. And as many students liked the teachers who praised them,
yes,
who saw
true.
What their talent was. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who pointed out to me that I had a literary life. I remember once in the hall he said to me, Mr. Bowe, how's your literary life? And I hadn't realized I had one. and I said, yes. And he's the one who made me realize I loved his class because he'd find a way of killing an hour for 3 days a week, killing an hour talking about Shakespeare and having it be great fun.
Mm-hmm.
And he never seemed overly prepared. He just opened the text and started talking about the play. We did all the plays over the year. And I thought that was a great way to spend your time was with Shakespeare. In graduate school, I always thought if you're going to spend time writing a dissertation, it better be on a great writer. I'm not going to, spend my time on, I don't want to pick on anybody who's
thinking. We understand. Third, fourth, fifth rate writer. They're out there.
They're out there who you can quickly get a dissertation. Robert Pinsky famously wrote a dissertation on some unknown terrible writer because he wanted a PhD quickly and then became a poet and famous and successful. But that wasn't for me. I wanted to do Shakespeare because Shakespeare seemed like the greatest writer, and I still think he is the greatest writer. I put Homer second in my – I don't know enough about non-Western writers, but it seems to me obviously Shakespeare is the greatest writer. England has produced the greatest writer, the greatest scientist ever, arguably Isaac Newton, and the creator of the greatest idea ever, Charles Darwin, all from this little island.
So you were, you've had this lifelong relationship with Shakespeare.
Yes.
But this book called Living the Shakespearean Life, True Stories, this is a very particular kind of book on Shakespeare. It's probably unlike anything that most of our listeners have ever
been exposed to. I don't think there's another book quite like it. There are books where people were asked to write essays, but these are oral histories. I started teaching a Shakespeare course for UC students in London in 2000. Then for 16 or 17 straight years, I went to London every summer and lived a Shakespearean life, which I loved. I'd spent a couple of months in London reading nothing but about Shakespeare, going to see plays at the Globe, anywhere, any Shakespeare play, even the ones my students weren't seeing, I'd go see. And I so loved immersing myself in Shakespeare, I started wondering how it changed me. Then I wondered how it changed other people who lived Shakespearean lives. Because there are people who, directors, who people who run the theaters in Ashland and elsewhere, Shakespeare scholars, Stephen Greenblatt, etc., who get to spend, James Shapiro said he spends 12 hours a day, 7 days a week on Shakespeare.
Probably for 60 years.
For 60 years, and he loves it. Most of the, and so I decided to start interviewing people. I had I was there in London and had time, was my wife would come over for half the time, but I was alone for most of the time. So I'd every year interview three or four people in England, and then when I'd go around the United States for conventions or whatever, I'd be in Chicago, I'd interview Barbara Gaines, who runs the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and David Bevington, the scholar at University of Chicago, and gathered till I ended up with 33 or 34 interviews. I transcribe them, edit them, send them to the person for correction. I'd always use a title. I'd ask the person to pick a quotation they like, and that would be the title of the interview.
So what did you, I mean, it's a really interesting book, and there, you know, we have Peter Lichtenfeld's here, is on our own campus, and other people who my life is intersected with for one reason or another. Do you think there was anything that you would take away that you found as a commonality, that there's something that happens, is there something Shakespearean that happens to people who spend their life with Shakespeare?
The main one is how much fun they seem to be having, how happy they are with the decision. And the more they're doing Shakespeare, over and over, people said, wow, this is really a good life that I get to live life with Shakespeare. Judi Dench famously called Shakespeare the man who pays the rent. And for me, he was and I interviewed people for whom Shakespeare was the man who pays the rent. One professor, Ann Thompson, in London at King's College, said that Shakespeare, with the possible exception of Jesus Christ, who was perhaps cheating by not being human, Shakespeare was the human being who provided more work for people than anyone else. And I think it's probably true. All the actors, directors, teachers, every university has Shakespeare professors.
Yes.
He has provided this living. And the one, people said commonality of things about Shakespeare. A little theory. Like most people talk about what they learned from Shakespeare. People talked about paying attention to what's right in front of you.
That's kind of odd, I think, in some ways, that Shakespeare is just a way of getting you to pay more attention to your own life.
To what's in front of you in your life. Ralph Allen Cohen talked about the moment in Twelfth Night. Twelfth Night, when Sebastian, the twin brother, shows up in town, where his twin sister has been wooing the Countess Olivia. Olivia thinks it's the boy and says, the Countess comes out and says, "Marry me," and he says, "Sure," and goes and marries her. And that is an example of you accept what's in front of you. You go, you sort of go with the flow. And King Lear sort of noticed the wretched beggars in front of you. Notice the poverty, and that's what he learned. Sort of, although not one person stood out, Stephen Booth of UC Berkeley, who I think is a brilliant man, said he's learned not one bloody thing from Shakespeare.
But he was one of the happy ones.
Oh, right? He was one of the happy ones.
Right, he was still happy, even though he didn't learn.
Even though he didn't learn, the idea, what you learn is generally speaking, learning is hard to talk about. How you learned what and what you learned.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me, one of the things I learned was all these Shakespeare phrases.
Yes,
that are like proverbs for me.
Mm-hmm.
When my wife says you seem whatever today, I say seems, madam. I know not seems from Hamlet. Or what am I reading? Words.
Uh-huh.
I don't go through a day without, because I know Shakespeare so well, without thinking of some Shakespearean phrase.
Mm-hmm. So Shakespeare, all this study of Shakespeare is definitely inhabiting these people's minds.
Yes.
As inhabiting and shaping the way they look at things and getting them, that idea is getting them to pay attention to a certain kind of thing. I was struck when I was looking through the interviews that the people have very individual relationships with the plays.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like no two people seem to agree completely, though there are certain plays that we see performed more. But when you talk to these people who have really dealt with Shakespeare for a long period of time, they have very idiosyncratic suggestions as to what are their favorite plays.
Oh, yes. Like the odd thing to me was how many people don't like The Tempest.
Yes.
That was just, because that was one of my favorite plays. But if you've seen it in performance, you understand why. It can be really boring. If you saw the Julie Taymor movie, the only good scenes were the Caliban Stefano Trinculo scenes.
Uh-huh.
The rest of Prospero's keeps talking about people falling asleep and telling the backstory. And we all think, this magician. More people liked Troilus and Cressida. That was a frequent, one of the high picks for a favorite was Troilus and Cressida, a play which most people have never even seen.
Right.
That was maybe performed once in Shakespeare's life. But it is a tremendous play. I've seen it a couple times. It's incredibly cynical, the point of view. All the heroes of the Trojan War are horrible people.
Yes.
Achilles on to Helen to anybody, Hector. They're all just horrible people, and it's just incredible. Nasty satire of human beings.
Uh-huh. Do you think that there's something about Shakespeare? I mean, it's very interesting to me that so many people see him glom onto different things and glom onto different parts of the play. Do you think there's something about him that is just very interpretively very fertile? That there's, you can apply him. Presumably, people have been applying him to their history and their locale in many different histories and locales. Yeah. That there's something about him that is incredibly flexible as an interpreting model, and that's one of the reasons why so many people turn to him.
Well, I think there are two reasons come to mind that people talked about. One is that he's sort of a romantic, that he only has one play that's set in contemporary England, The Merry Wives of Windsor, and even at the end of that, he has children dressed up as fairies and Falstaff thinks they're real fairies.
Uh-huh.
If you write things tied to your time and place, it tends to die out of your time and place.
Yes, exactly.
When you write out of fantasies, and I think actually he wrote out of folk tales and fairy tales a lot.
Yes.
Like the pound of flesh motif in Merchant of Venice is a folktale motif. It existed before he didn't get that from literature. He got them from folktales, and he obviously knew a million folktales growing up, as people, especially country boys like him, did growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one that makes him so fertile, as many people pointed out, he seems to like all his characters, even the villains. He sympathized with Macbeth. You're forced in the play to sympathize with Iago, the worst person in the world. But you tend on the stage to like the person who talks to you, who gives a soliloquy.
Mm-hmm.
So Shakespeare's plays were like storytelling. The lights were on. What I like about performing as a storyteller is you see the audience and you respond to them. As an actor, I've done some acting, and I find it creepy that you don't see the audience except for the people in the first row.
But for Shakespeare, you did.
In the Globe Theater, they have the lights on. And in Staunton, Virginia, at their Blackfriars Playhouse, indoor, but they keep the lights on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a different dynamic. And so when Iago is there looking at you and talking to you. You know he's terrible, but you sort of like him because he's sharing himself and telling all the secrets of the play and what's going on to you.
So you build a kind of bridge to these characters, whether or not you like them.
Whether or not you like them,
I mean,
yes.
In that way, I think the ambivalence is very similar to things from Greek tragedy, where you also, it's not a simple world of good and bad. People you're supposed to dislike quite a bit, you somehow have some sympathy for. And other people who you're supposed to like a lot do very annoying things.
I think that's an excellent connection, which I hadn't thought of. I think absolutely that's true. It is like that.
So do you think there is, I mean, if you were trying to get students to think about this now, because I'm always interested in sort of the difficulty of getting students to read complicated texts. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge I've worked with for many, many years. And I had a terrific experience with Shakespeare. Interestingly enough, before I came to Davis, I taught for 1 year at Emory, and I read Romeo and Juliet. And this was a group of honor students, and we just kept reading the prologue over and over and over and over. And I felt kind of bad because there was a semester, which is even longer than a quarter, and we never plumbed the depths of that prologue. Yeah. So we never knew what happened in the rest of the play.
Well, what happens in the rest of the play isn't what the prologue says is going to happen.
Yes, that's what people think.